the pshat on in Rus, the Book of Rus. You heard of the Book of, in English it's translated the Book of Rus. It's an interesting story. I wouldn't mind doing it. I'm teaching it at the high school now. The other thing is, it's not clear to me what the underlying idea is. It's four chapters. It's very consistent. Four chapters. Maybe you should read it and start making your own observations. But the essential thing is, revolves around the woman Ruth, who was the ancestress of King David.
Yeah.
And she is the prototype of the true convert. And so it's about this family that left. It takes place at the time of the Shoftim, at the time of the judges, which is during the first few hundred years when the Jews entered the land. This is before they had a king in Israel. It says, but he made Shoftim. And then there was a famine in the land, and this individual Elimelech was very, very wealthy. He left the land because of the famine, and he's criticized because that was an act that was a lacking in compassion. He was afraid that, according to most interpretations, he was afraid that his wealth would be consumed. But he should have stayed and helped out the people. And he left and he went to the land of Moab. And then his sons, Machlon and Kilion, married these two Moabite women. And they see they were righteous women. Now it seems, from a plain reading of the story, Rashi learns this way, that these women did not convert. That they married these women that had not converted at the time of the marriage. So you see that they had deteriorated, they had gone down to a lower level. But nevertheless, the wife, Elimelech dies, and his two sons die, Machlon and Kilion, and the wife of Elimelech, her name was Noemi, and the Chazal says that Noemi was pleasant because her deeds were very pleasant. She was a perfected woman. And she remained there for 10 years, and her daughters-in-law, so to speak, remained with her. Apparently they were righteous women too, even though they had not converted, and they had a tremendous compassion because she was a widow in a strange land. And they had lost their wealth. And these two girls stayed with them, which is very unusual. You'd imagine their husbands had died. They'd want to return to their own life, you know, rebuild the life for themselves. They stayed with her. Anyways, then what happens is that the famine, Noemi finds out that the famine has ended and she wants to return to the land of Israel. So as she's departing, the two girls, apparently they were very attached to her. You know, she was numbing this pleasantness. She was a pleasant person. And it seems that she was a very perfected individual. And the two girls were on a high level as well. And they were attached. They didn't want to separate from her. So it's very interesting. It describes the story of how they're actually, she's leaving on the road and they're clinging to her. They don't want to leave. They want to come back with her. Okay, but bear in mind that to come back with her would imply that they have to convert. And although this is not on the overt level, nevertheless, again with the Midrash, Chazal see this as being, reading between the lines, it is a description of the, you know, what to do when a person wants to convert. And we learn that many laws from this. But again, it's along the lines that you've been raising, Don, about how the story is on one level, but you know, embedded within the story are deeper ideas from which we learn that, we can learn that on halacha and so forth. So if you want to pick it up, chapter 1 from verse from Vav, Pasuk Vav 6. So it says that she got up with her daughters-in-law and they returned from the fields of Moab, because they had heard in the fields of Moab that God had remembered his nation to give them bread. In other words, the famine had come to an end. So it says they left from the place where they had stayed, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they traveled on the road to return to the land of Yehuda, from whence they had come. So they were traveling together. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go and return, each one of you, to the house of your mother. Each one of you should go back. In other words, the time has come for us to separate. And then she blesses them. May God be compassionate with you, as you've been compassionate with the deceased and with me. Which means that even though, you know, we became connected only because of the marriage, but even after that's chesed, that you, even after they died, you didn't just abandon me. You, you know, you remained faithful. And may God give you menucha. Menucha over here is a rare, because I'll say it's a reference to a new life, a husband. Each one of you, may you all find, you know, may you find security, each one in the house of her husband. So she kissed them, and they lifted their voices and they cried. It was a very emotional type of a scene. But you see that she's really pressing them to leave. This would also indicate that they weren't, that they had not converted. Because had they converted, why would she impose, why should she tell them to go back to a place of idolatry? And they said to her, no, we're going to return with you to your nation. Now there's an indication that they want to convert. Now you know that the procedure is when a person comes to convert that you're supposed to try and discourage him at first. It's a delicate procedure because you want to ascertain whether the person is sincere and don't have any ulterior motive. So Naomi now tries to dissuade her. She says, please my daughters, return. Why would you come with me? Do I still have any children in my womb that you'll have for husbands? In other words, she's trying to ascertain that perhaps there's some ulterior motives over here. And she says, please, my daughters, go back because I'm too old. I'm too old to get married. Because even if I were to, I'm not going to go through all the nuances here, but basically, even if I were to get married tonight, I'm too old for a marriage, but even if I were, and even if I were to have to become pregnant again, would you wait for them until they grew up? In other words, the whole idea is absurd. I don't have any more children for you. I don't have anybody for you to marry anymore. Okay? So then they created, then now, Pasuk Yudalit, they lifted their voices and they cried again. And interestingly enough, Arpa kisses her mother-in-law, and she leaves. But Ruth clung to her. So the method of discouragement worked for Arpa, but didn't work for Ruth. Ruth clung to her. So now she says, "Behold, your sister-in-law has returned to her nation." So now she's working on Ruth. It appears that Ruth has a stronger conviction, and to her God. She's returned. Now you, she tells her, you return after your sister-in-law. You go back too. But Ruth was very adamant. And Ruth said, do not pressure me to abandon you, to go, to leave you. And then this is the famous quote, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your nation is my nation, and your God is my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. Thus, it's like an oath, may God do to me and increase, for only death will separate us. So this is we don't have many laws from this. She wants to be part of the nation, she accepts upon herself. All these things imply, you know, she's part of Klal Yisrael, your nation is my nation. Also, Rashi learns out in the fact that that she says, where you lodge, I will lodge. That this is a reference. It's a reference to various halachas. For example, Rashi says, "Where you go, ki el asher telchi ele. Where you go, I will go." So Rashi takes that as a reference to that she had taught her, because she's supposed to teach the convert some. Some of the more stringent laws and some of the more lenient laws, more, you know, easier laws. So Shabbos, for example, this is a reference to Tum Shabbos. Wherever you go, I'll go. In other words, you can't go on Shabbos, you're limited in travel. It's an implication over there. Okay? And with Linu, with lodging, it's a reference to Yichud. that you can't, the lodge wherever you want the lodge, you know, that type of thing. Okay. Now, take a look, the next pasuk is pasuk Yudchas. So it says, Vatera ki misametes hi lalechas ita. And she saw, so Nami saw that she was strengthening, you know, like she was really imposing herself to go with her. So Vatechtel davarla. So then she stopped. So from this, you see that first she really is very, puts a lot of pressure on her. She tries to discourage her. But then suddenly she stops. So again, that's the halacha, that at first you're supposed to, it's sort of like, you know, you have to, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you want to discourage, because that's the, what's the philosophy over here? What's the objective? Is the objective to prevent, it's a funny kind of an approach, no other religion would have this approach. Is the objective to win this person over, or is the objective to keep this person away? The answer is, the objective is to accept this person only if they are totally sincere. So that's why you have to go through this procedure, which at first is the point of discouraging them is to ascertain. But once you've ascertained, then you cannot, you see, you can't discourage them after it's clear that they're sincere. Because then you're pushing them away from the truth. Once you've established that their motivation is sincere, so then you can't overdo it. So that's the general idea of the pasuk, that once she had ascertained, once she had gone through all of the steps in discouraging her, so then she ceased. But I wanted to give you over the pshat of the Vilna Gaon. It's a different type of an approach, different type of pshat, but he has a very interesting idea over there. He's interpreting this pasuk, and she saw that she was like misametim chazak niyamatz, means when you tell someone like grab a hold of yourself, you know, like be strong. The implication is it's a situation where you have to really force yourself. You have to go against certain resistances. You know, there are certain resistances, right? Because there's this person is disinclined to do certain things. So you exhort him. It's an exhortation to strengthen yourself, to be strong. Don't give in to your emotions. Now he says like this. Yetzer HaTov. He talks about the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer Ra. He says the Yetzer HaTov only counsels a person to do a mitzvah. But the Yetzer Hara, that's the Yetzer HaTov, is the good inclination. But the Yetzer Hara tries to persuade him to do Averos, to do sin. The Yimyira She'eino Yocholo. Now, if it sees that it can't succeed with him, Mifatehu Lasos Mitzvah V'utaf Kama Averos. This is a very interesting idea. Then it tries to seduce him to do a mitzvah which is covered with many averos. He's saying that it's not so simple. Sometimes a person wants to do a mitzvah. In his own mind, he believes he's an idealist, but there are many ulterior motives. That mitzvah may conceal very many ulterior motives which stem from a different side of the personality. Very often a person gets seized with the idea to lead a movement, you know, or a certain project, and to build, and so forth. Now in his own mind, he thinks it's all for the ideal, it's all for the good. Yeah, but there are secret motivations that he himself may not be aware of. Maybe he'll be making some money out of it, maybe he'll be getting some fame out of it, maybe he'll be making an impression on certain people. You see what I'm saying? In other words, very often, you know, a person is doing something and he can, and objectively it's a mitzvah. Everything he's doing is a mitzvah. Yeah, but now there's a question. Is the desire stemming from from the idealistic component, the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, right? But he says that, this is what he's saying, that the evil inclination has another access. The evil inclination, its first objective is to try and seduce you to do the sin directly. Right?
But if it fails at that, a person resists it, so then it has another avenue. It comes at you in a different way, and it's dressed up in the form of a mitzvah. And that mitzvah means by its ma'uta, that the mitzvah can, the good deed, can contain within it many, many motivations which stem from the Yetzer Hara. Okay? Now I think we can all relate to that. The idealism is structured in such a way that it can contain, an idealistic project can contain many avenues for and channels which a person can gratify his instincts. It may be in a more disguised form, it may be a more sublimated form, but nevertheless, the motivation behind it can be to gratify the Yetzer Hara. That's what he's saying. And then he quotes a statement of Chazal that says that Yitzro Shel Adam Mizgavrel of Bechol Yom Umizcharesh, that the inclination of man becomes more powerful upon him, gains strength on him every day, Umizcharesh, and becomes renewed. So he explains it along these lines. Mizgaber means that the Gvuros becomes more powerful, Sheyasa Averos, that he should do Averos. That's one thing. In other words, the Yetzer, the first objective, the first course of the Yetzer is to get the guy to do Averos. And with Charesh is like transforms itself, becomes new. Hainu imroa shelo yifata osol Avera. If it sees that it can't seduce him into sin, Macharesh alav mafatoso b'mitzvah. So then you have Macharesh, it changes course. Chiddush, it becomes like, something different. To try and seduce him with a mitzvah. Uvizem utaf ha'avera k'derech ha'yetzer. And with this, the avera is covered, it's concealed. According to the inclination, the evil inclination. Now, he says as follows. How do you know the difference? That's the question. How do you know the difference? When a person now, according to him, a person can want to do a mitzvah, it can be either because of the mitzvah, or it could be because of the Yetzer Hara. V'yarotza lifchon, eis bol liyodo ha-mitzvah. The person wants to test. At the time when the mitzvah comes into his hand, in whom the Yetzer Hara, or if it's from the Yetzer Hara, Olo or not. So he gives a practical test. Is Yachin the ace asiyas a mitzvah? He should test himself at the time of the doing of the mitzvah. Now you tell me, I'll just give you the situation. You tell me which, he gives you a test. You tell me, which one it's from. Ime varav no'im v'nodim. If his limbs are like moving and shaking. V'esahi. At that time, with his rizos, lasses a mitzvah, and he has this tremendous feeling of enthusiasm. The person's all excited about the mitzvah. His limbs, like to the extent, it's just a metaphor. Okay? His limbs are shaking. He wants to do that mitzvah. Okay, so what is that a sign of? What would you say that comes from? There are two moods. Sometimes you're doing a mitzvah and you're not in that much of an optimistic mood. You feel a lot of resistance, you don't feel like doing it, but you go, ugly kind of a thing. But you go ahead and do it. You sort of force yourself. Other times is the time to a mitzvah and you really feel to the extent where you're like, you can't wait and you feel enthusiasm and so forth. These are the two possible states. Okay? Now, that's what he's going to provide us with. One of those cases, he says, would be, I'm not telling you which is which, I'm leaving it to you to see how you would think. In one of those cases, that's an indication. These are the two states. One of them indicates that the source is from the Yetzer Hara. He says if he's in that state where his limbs are shaking and he feels this tremendous enthusiasm, he says most probably this is coming from the counsel of the evil inclination. For how can it be that the limbs of the heavy limbs of the body Hashem may offer Yisodim that come from dust. The Tivam Lelech Achar Tavasam, and their Teva, their nature, is to follow their instincts. Hagufani, their physical instincts. Yislapshu Ratzon, how is it possible that they will become, you know, take on the cloak of a desire, will take on a desire, lasos, to do the mitzvah. Einze ki imatzas yetzahara. This is nothing but the advice, the counsel of the evil inclination. Birdei sheyilokei achakach berishto. In order that he should be trapped afterwards in its net. V'im b'teshukas nafsho apnimius. But if this were to come from the desire of his innermost soul, l'skariv eloseu, to draw closer to his creator, b'masai ha-mitzvos, with masai ha-mitzvos. In other words, what would be the reaction if this were stemming from some other component within his personality, from his the desire of his soul to become closer to the creator? He's saying if that were the case, evar ha-guf kvedim, then the limbs of his body would be heavy, v'atzelim, and lazy. It'd be resistance. Oz nirish emiderach ha-tevahu. That would be the natural, that would be the natural, because that would be in line with their own nature. And he goes on, he mentions another point. So the thing is like this. I would say, just like this. Vatera ki misameta si lalechas. He goes back to the pasuk now. It's a beautiful explanation of the pasuk. Fits in with the words. Because she was trying to convince her not to go. To go back, turn back, Rus. And then the pasuk says, at what point did she stop? When she saw that she was determined. She was like forcing herself. She was forcing herself, right, to go. So he reads it like this. Also here, Amy Yecholo Lelech Acharav. It turns out Rus was not able to go out, to follow her anymore, even though she was much younger than her. Rus was young, you know. Naomi was an older woman. Bilti Amitz Beguf. She couldn't follow anymore unless she. That's the implication. The implication is she had to force herself. It's an implication of the word. That's not the simple translation. Again, that's not the simple translation, but there's a certain nuance, an implication. That this is unnatural because she's younger and she should be, physically she was stronger, but she had now to force herself to go. Via Giyarabba, she had to work very hard to just go. Ha'az v'techtal. So then she ceased dissuading her. L'mnoa osa me'a mitzvot. Then she stopped dissuading her from the mitzvot. Ki hakavana mitzara tovu. Because she saw that the intention was, in other words, that's the implication in the pasuk. The implication in the pasuk was that she had to strengthen herself. That she wasn't running after her with this natural. That is the point at which Naomi saw that she was sincere. That it wasn't with this fervor, this superficial zeal and fervor and enthusiasm. But she was really forcing herself. Now, if that's the case, that shows that it really stems from the innermost desire to do the good. But it's an interesting idea. You see, it's very interesting because today it's just the opposite. That everybody says just the opposite. That when a person's in that state, they encourage that, to be in that state of zeal, you know, that religious fervor, the state of fervor, is really regarded as a very good thing. According to this, you have to be extremely suspicious of it. When a person, what is preferable? Oh yeah, well certainly it's preferable in terms of perfection to do the mitzvot out of the incentive, out of the Yetzer Tov. That's clearly the case. But he's not saying that it's evil. We're not saying that it's evil. But what is very important though is that a person should be able to recognize his motive and not to mistake a emotion of fervor. That's very dangerous. If a person mistakes an emotion of fervor, which is stemming from the instinctual, if he mistakes that for which most people do, I believe there's a lot of that going on. That's why, for example, this case you mentioned, I mean, you know, these instantaneous conversions, you know, so to speak. I mean, even amongst Jews, it's called Baal Tshuva, where you find that happening, where, the last 20, 25 years, the person is living a complete instinctual lifestyle. All of his desires, lust, and so forth. And suddenly, overnight, he finds religion, and he's jumping and screaming, you know, to go, he loves to daven, he loves this, he loves that. That's not the way it works. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because the person is closer to the truth, but to mistake that as being that emotion that he feels as being a sign of perfection, that religious fervor that he feels, that's contrary to what the Vilna Gaon is saying. That fervor is obviously stemming from something else, because it's an impossibility. It's an impossibility, I mean, we'll put it in our terms, that a person whose energy is all directed towards the instinctual, that would produce a state of conflict. That's what he means. So naturally a person should be in a state of conflict. And you see, there is a concept of reason by bima l'mitzvah. There is a concept where a person does feel, there's two types, he's not talking about that here, there are two types of religious zeal. There is a zeal which stems from the Yetzer HaTov, from the good inclination. We're talking about, the context over here is like someone like Nami, a beginner. It would seem to me almost impossible for a beginner to feel. I'm sorry? By Rus, we're talking about Rus, you're right. To start out with, what he seems to be saying is that when a person is in a state of conflict, that there is a component within him which senses the good and has desire for the good, but until he reaches a certain level, the result of that would result in putting him in a state of conflict. His body isn't going along with it. the way man is constructed by nature. Now, he says when he's in that state and his body is not going along with it, yet he still wants to do it, that's good. That shows that it's pure. Because if it were not pure, if it were impure, that would mean that it would be stemming from the, it would be deriving energy, right, from the Yetzer Hara. Then he would not be, that would be eliminating. What's eliminating the resistance? What's causing the body to want to go along with this? Oh, according to him, it's not the desire to do the good. The body has no desire to do the good. The emotions have no desire to do the good. So therefore, it has to be that what's producing the emotion is that it's become aligned with the mitzvah. Somehow the emotion is being gratified. So that deal is an emotional deal. A person should be aware of that. It doesn't mean to say that he shouldn't do the mitzvah. I think what Moshe is saying is very good. The important thing is to be aware of it and to identify it correctly, not to be misled by it. Because if a person, that could kill a person. When a person is misled, false idealism, can be, that's the most dangerous force. And a person, because in his own mind, all of his energy is now tied in with a false ideal, and there's nothing to stop him anymore. There's nothing to stop him, yeah, because he thinks he's doing the right thing. Nobody said it's a bad thing. I'm just quoting from the Vilna Gaon, and all he said is, if you want to distinguish, and apparently he's saying it's important to distinguish whether it's coming from the Yetzer Tov or the Yetzer Ra. So it is important to distinguish. Here's a litmus test, so to speak. Okay, that's all I'm saying. He didn't say that. That's why it's a beautiful interpretation. It's a very beautiful interpretation of the pasuk, you see? Because it fits in with the words. The nuance is beautiful. That there was a certain reluctance, that she had to strengthen herself to overcome a certain natural resistance. So when Naomi saw that, she said, this person is genuine. I mean, you see, for example, the idea of zeal, of using a zeal to motivate people, a fervor, to induce that type of a thing, can be a very dangerous thing, because it can lead to serious distortion. So, now many people are look at it superficially and they say, well, this person is now, you know, let's say you use this messianic type of thing. But to convince people that if they do mitzvot and everything, Mashiach is coming and all that, they produce all these emotions. Now these emotions clearly are not rooted in the proper desire to serve God. They're evoking a certain fantasy in people. That's the Yetzer Hara. But in order to satisfy that fantasy, so you have to now put on film every day and do, you know, all these different things. But you're not doing it for the true reason. Now that is a example of what we're talking about, fervor and zeal, inducing a feeling of fervor and zeal. And in the person's mind, he really thinks that suddenly he's found God. But it's not. Because the idea of God in his mind can be associated with so many fantasies. So it's a very dangerous kind of a game.
Well, how does one know his own mind?
Ah, well, that's exactly what he's saying. That's exactly what he's trying to tell you. He said, he gave you one case. If you are in a state of conflict, if you want to do it, but your limbs are not jumping to do it, but still in all, there is something within you that's telling you to do it, then that's a sign that it's coming from that's a better situation. You see, in other words, what he's saying is, don't forget, you have to realize also, I think there's two types of individual. This is the type of individual at the outset. Because the Rambam does talk about someone who serves God out of love, and that seems to be completely the opposite. All of his emotions are propelling him. So that we'll discuss tomorrow, the concept. How does this idea, if this is true, what about everything we've learned about those who serve God out of love, and they get tremendous enjoyment. According to the Vilna Gaon, mean that we're always in a state of conflict, you know, like we're always pulled in two different directions. Okay, that I'll leave for tomorrow. The thing about this idea of the Vilna Gaon, about the conflict, the way the Yetzer Hara operates, is that it is difficult for a person to be an overt sinner. It's not in line with his nature, with his constitution. The Yetzer Hara, what he's talking about, means the instinctual side of man, the force of instinct. And leads him to go in a certain direction. But God did not leave him at the mercy of the Yetzer Hara. God did have built-in protection, so to speak. We'll see this more if you make a note. We'll pick this up in the story of Adam, the sin of Adam and the punishment. For the time being, we do see that man does have what we would call a Yetzer Hara. We're not identifying it that precisely, but there is an inclination which runs counter to the Yetzer Hara. A person has emotions, he has a certain self-image that he has to maintain. It's not even base people, there's something called guilt. Guilt is a very powerful force. You can't negate from, you see it in, you know, even in the obsessive things, you see people suffering from emotional. A lot of the suffering today that manifests itself in physical form is really psychological. And a lot of it has to do with this conflict. If the people are in this state, they can't resolve the conflict because, on the one hand, their instinctual desires are for one thing, but if they have to gratify them, then they're going to wake it over, wind up feeling even worse. That's what they call the morning after. They feel horrible about it. Why? Because under the a person's always prey, he's always prone to this type of a mistake. That's why people get into a lot of mistakes. What happens is unseen emotions come into the picture. When a person has a desire for something, then the fact that it's wrong is not that strong. The fact that it's wrong is not that the powerful a deterrent. Unless the person's on a very, very high level of perfection, because the instinctual desire changes the character of the deed and causes him to distort the moral nature of the deed. That's how the Yetzer Hara works. It convinces him that it's really a good thing. It's hard for him to see the depth. There's a very powerful association with wine between that which is appealing. So a person is hungry. When a person is hungry, you see this happening all the time. I mean, people that have suffering with obesity, with weight. So they go to the restaurant, and they're hungry. So then all they can think about is the meal, and it's like a one-day delicious meal. And they're happy to eat it and so on and so forth. And then few hours later, when they wake up the next morning, they get on the scale and they feel miserable about it. They have a totally different attitude towards what they do. But it's not as if they didn't know that they have this problem. It's not as if they didn't know that they go on a scale. So you see that there's a transformation taking place. And that is that, and that's something a person should be on guard against. Something a person should be aware of in his own nature, that the distorting mechanism of desire. Desire produces a distorting mechanism. And therefore, under the sway of desire, a person has a completely different attitude towards whatever the object is. Whether it be a person, it could be many relationships are based upon this. You could get married on the basis of this. And then they find out the person is totally different. But once that emotion isn't there anymore, once that emotion is gone, so now you're looking at it realistically, like a, and realistically, it's completely different. And the same, it's a good piece of advice with regard to any type of venture that a person is going to go into, to recognize when he's under the sway of a certain emotion. And even if you're going to buy a house or buy a car or something, so you have a, when you go into a certain feeling, and of course salesmanship seeks to evoke that feeling. Now the smart thing to do, two things a person should do in this situation. First of all, you should have a good friend. That's where a good friend comes into the picture. A good friend is one who is committed to your true best interests and who doesn't share the same emotion that you have. You tend to bring along those friends who have the same emotion. They love cars too. So they're caught up in the same emotion. It's wise to bring along someone that does not share the emotion and is looking at it objectively. The second thing one should do is that you should not make the, I mean, if possible, you always have to look at it. If possible, like they say, the worst time to go shopping, food shopping, is when you're hungry. Yeah, if it's 10, the emotion has a, of course, the best thing to do then is after you've gone is to wait, to think it over. Of course, the salesman is trying to get you to sign. He's always telling you if you don't do it right now. This thing is, but that's nonsense, you know it. The same deal with, you know, the deal didn't just come to being at this particular moment if you walk into the showroom. By and large, with rare exceptions, those types of things will exist. I mean, there are cases where, you know, you have to exploit, you have to be able to exploit, but that's different. So the best thing to do is to walk away from the situation and ponder it, you know, for a few weeks and then see. And then see how it, whether, you know, whether you still see it the same way. Don't allow yourself to be, you know, moved into the, that's what they're trying, they'll always have that thing. That's why they, on the other side, they're training the salesman to get the guy to commit. All these high-powered salesmanships is some type of commitment. Put something down, sign on the line. You close, etc. But once you're in there, once they get you in there, they know that one thing leads to another, and then it's more difficult for you to back out. Once you've committed, it's more difficult for you to back out. However, once you escape and you go home, that other thing, you know, you speak to your wife, you speak to your friends, you speak to others, you know, it dissipates. So their objective is to get you to sign immediately, to lock you in. Your objective is to avoid that. So therefore, what the Vilna-Gaon is saying over here is that the Yetzer, of course, seeks to get a person to do the Avera, but that is not always doable because the person has defenses. So then it has, this is the, the tricky, the sneaky mechanism that it uses. It seeks to disguise itself in the form of a mitzvah. And that's why a person doing a mitzvah, he says, that mitzvah can be cloaked in the Yetzer Hara. And a person can do, that's what we call ulterior motive. Now, in his own mind, he really is the perfect solution. Because this is what the ego is striving for. The ego is striving to find a solution to this problem, a way of gratifying the instinct in a manner which will not only not evoke the condemnation of the conscience, but will even get the applause of the conscience. Now, there's one occupation in which we see this very, very clearly. Politics is one of the most blatant. Lawyers is another one, you know. Even rabbis, the rabbinate. You see? You can see how the rabbinate can become, can lend itself to this type of thing. Religion, Well, today you see so many different forms of corruption in religion, corrupt people using religion. Religion can easily, I'm talking about religion in general now, so I keep it, impartial. You know, religion per se attracts people, because people can, they have an avenue of achieving what they want, power, recognition, egotism, practical benefits, money, control over other people's lives, and all in the guise of saving their souls. So it's a beautiful, business. It's a business. So in most cases, that's what it is. You see, politics is clearly, politics is the blatant expression of that. That's why politicians always use this idea of public service. It's total nonsense. There's no public service. If they're a true public servant, they finish his job, comes home, whatever it is, at 4 or 5 o'clock, then he goes in to a federal building and offers his volunteers. They feel like people, there are people that do this, like they go to the shul. You know, Israel have people that work for the shul at night, and they have time, and they don't get paid for it, they don't get power and an office and a staff and a pension and so on. What kind of, that's personal service, cologne, you know. That's why there's so much corruption in government, because it's a business. At the same time, they bask in this mantle of being public service. Okay? Like their job is really noble. What's noble about it? Absolutely. They, especially today, when it's so corrupt, there's so much corruption and nepotism, taking care of their own favors, paying their favors and so forth. I don't see anything to be proud about it. Alright, we'll get back to that in a different area. I'll tell you what I really think about the way the government is. So, he said that that the Yetzara seeks to seduce a person to the form of a mitzvah. And he now finds a mitzvah in which there's a secret agenda, in which he can gratify many of his instinctual desires. And then he said, how do we know? How can you distinguish between the two? How do you know when you have a desire to do a mitzvah, whether it's from the Yetzer HaTov or the Yetzer Hara? So he gives us this litmus test. And that is that when a person has the time of the mitzvah, the time comes to do the mitzvah, so his limbs are shaking, so to speak, and he feels tremendous excitement and tremendous enthusiasm to do the mitzvah. He says, if that's the case, you could most probably it's from the Yetzer Hara. Because how can the body, which tends to go after its physical nature and its desires, doesn't get excited about any mitzvah, which is a completely different phenomenon. And to get close to God to the performance of his mitzvah. That's not something which excites the body and excites the mitzvah. But if he sees that he, at the time of the mitzvah, that his limbs are very heavy and there's tremendous resistance, so that's a sign that it's coming from the nature of that. Okay? It puts a whole different spin on the idea of religious fervor and zeal. All of this fervor and zeal, you know, people are jumping and running and all of that, according to the Holy Ghost, one should be very suspicious of that. Yeah, I didn't say, he didn't say you should be able to do both things in yourself, though. We're not saying that you shouldn't do the mitzvah, but it would be dangerous to misidentify that zeal as being something which comes from the Yetzer HaTov, as being a expression of the true desire. That's where people go awry. And this is what causes a lot of these movements in Judaism. They wind up with serious distortions. I think the Torah refers to as Eish Zara, the foreign zeal, foreign fire. There's a fire to do something, and on the surface it's adopting the form of a mitzvah, but the underlying fire is a different fire. The fire is an emotional, instinctual thing. You have to guard against that. You have to be very careful. Because if that is the case, then it could be destructive. That's what he says. That's the point
he leads it into the dialogue that she was seeking to dissuade Naomi. Naomi was seeking to dissuade Ruth. But then it says that she was misameta, that she was forcing herself. He interprets that to mean that physically she became weaker, she couldn't move. And she's much younger than Naomi. Ruth was much younger than Naomi. She should have had an easy time keeping up with her. So, but why did she, why did her limbs become heavy? Because of the mitzvah. So then it says, so Naomi saw that, so she saw that her limbs were heavy upon her, that, so then she stopped, then she saw that it must be from the Yetzer HaTov, must be from the Yetzer HaTov, because she wasn't running after the mitzvah. So that's the concept. Now, let's take it from there. We, yeah, go ahead. So what, to discuss, what about the idea that the Rambam speaks about it, the 10th Perek of Tshuva, about serving God out of love, that the perfected individual serves God out of love, and all of his thoughts, all of his actions, and he describes it, it's a very powerful, very powerful phenomenon. He says that's the state of Avram, that he serves God out of love, and that all of his thoughts, just like when a person is in love, he can't think of anything else except the love object. So too, when a person has achieved the love of God, he's completely preoccupied. Everything he does is motivated by the love of God. So that would seem to be someone, a person in love runs to do the, there's no resistance. I mean, this seems to be contrary, right? In other words, we're always saying, this idea could, is probably not, we're always saying that a person, that there is a, that this is in line with man's nature. If the Torah is really in line with man's nature, this is, we were discussing, this is the true good, this is the true joy. Moreover, it says that we should serve God with joy. And that's a very important element. The Rambam says to serve, that the joy that a person has in the serving of God is the highest level of service. It's the real service. So how does this idea that the... Now, Chazal say the same thing. Chazal say that you should serve God with the Yetzer Hara and with the Yetzer HaTov. You should serve God with your evil inclination and with your good inclination. And that already indicates that it can't be, you know, that it can't be in line with the ordinary view. That there's two. First of all, that's a very hard idea. What is it? What is an evil inclination? How can an inclination, how can something which is part of nature be evil in and of itself? What is it that makes it evil? And, you know, what exactly is going on? Is there some kind of battle going on with you between two forces? If that's the case, so where do you come into the picture? What's your role? The Chazal put it into a different framework altogether because of that statement. They're saying that you should serve God with your... Who is you in this case? Who is you and who is the Yetzer? And you know, what's the idea behind that? So, let's see if we can understand that. What's the concept? And there's two concepts over there. One concept is to serve God with the Yetzer Hara. Now, on the surface, that seems to be difficult because the Yetzer Hara seems to be bad. It doesn't serve God. You think you're supposed to negate it. You're supposed to get away from it or whatever. Here we're saying, you're supposed to serve God with it. So let's try and understand that. And then we'll try and understand. That's one difficulty. The difficulty on the other side is to serve God with your Yetzer And Torah also is difficult to understand. Why is that difficult to understand? Because, what do you mean? So, I thought that's what the Eighth Child is doing. It's in the service of God. I mean, it seems like that in and of itself is not enough. See, that's a very important, a crucial kind of a statement. That's a statement which opens up a door over here. Both positions do not seem to make sense for different reasons. I think if we analyze them, we'll have a clear picture of what's going on. The idea, the Christian idea, that is, they objectify certain emotions and they treat them as though they were external forces. That's based upon their concept that man really does not have free will. It does not have free will, and it cannot perfect himself. He's corrupt by nature, and therefore he's in need of some type of a supernatural phenomenon to save him. You know, they make work out this idea of grace, you know, or salvation, something like that. But they really believe that you can't conquer. It's all a mystical kind of thing. You really, man cannot perfect himself. He's evil by nature. That's the view. And that's why they have this whole myth about so Jesus died for you. The whole stupidity. That's clearly not the idea of Yahweh. And even though we speak about a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Hatov, we're using terminology, but we're talking about different components of the human personality that a person has to be aware of. Components of the human personality. And the statement itself says that you should serve God with them. So clearly that's stating that you control. The Torah itself, it's a complete distortion of Torah to come to these notions, because it's a, God told Adam, the Atah control. Well, you will rule over it. You will rule over the snake, which is basically the evil inclination. The evil inclination is the, according to this formula, that's the snake. In the story of Adam, the Chayter of Adam, which we're going to be going into. But the basic idea, and you see that throughout the story of Cain and Hevel, when God intercedes and speaks to Cain before he kills Hevel, why is your face fallen, and so forth. Hello, Tatev, if you shall do good, then your face will be uplifted. But basically, it's all up to you. It's all in your hands to do good. But that's a foundation of Judaism. That the man has the capacity to perfect himself, to be good. And he's got to deal with these various components. All the terms, inclination, evil inclination, and so on and so forth, are just references to different components in the personality. And again, even when you call it evil, it's not evil by nature. Because if it was evil by nature, then how could Chazal ever say that you should serve God with something which is evil? Right? That would be a complete absurdity. God with your inclination seems to be similar to what the human God said. That the when a person sees that his limbs are he's saying, how do you know when the HRA when doesn't succeed in getting a person to do an avera, so it gets him to do a mitzvah which incorporates many avera. Cover. A mitzvah can be a cover from that, can be an outlet from any emotion. He says, how do you know the difference? The difference is when you see yourself all charged up and excited and full of enthusiasm, because most probably it's from the Yetzer Hara. This is not the nature of the body. It's a feel that way. It's a beautiful insight. In religion, it's very important to know yourself, to know your level. Now, I don't think anybody would say that's what we call low lishma, not for its own sake, for ulterior motives, if you want to use that expression. And that's something which is extremely important. The person doing mitzvot for ulterior motives, lo lishma, that is something which is an extremely important topic. Because if you answer no, if you say that it's impure and you should only do it for the right reason, then you're going to, you're taking a high moral position, but you're going to face a big problem. What's the problem? It's like a lonely universe out there. Right? You're not going to have much company. But if you're going to, if you're going to say that you shouldn't do something except for the proper motive, then it's going to involve it's against the plan of the Torah, basically. Because then it'll only relate to people who are pretty much by nature are from you automatically. There are some people like that that gravitate towards the good. Naturally, almost naturally. Everybody has free will, but you see that with some people it's more in line with their nature. But that's very rare. Someone with a philosophical nature. And you see in history, it's not just amongst the Jews. You see, I was thinking of Einstein, a Jewish, but he wasn't a Torah personality. I'm sure you find it amongst the nation, philosophers, Aristotle, Socrates. You have people that are, by nature, they gravitate towards what's true. But that's very rare. Most people are caught up in the instinctual. So therefore, how are you going to get an instinctual being to be involved in something which is counter to the instinct? That's what the Vilna Gaon is talking about. And the solution is by appealing to certain very powerful instincts. And in order to gratify those instincts, you've got to go through this channel. That's the mechanism of low response. And for example, the Rambam. The Rambam says in the introduction to Parabel, that's how you teach children. You don't teach children to study by telling them that studying is truly the best activity for a person. It's ridiculous. They can't relate to that. So you have to use rewards. So the study, which is the end, has now become a means to an end. You've got to make that into a means. And so how does it work? And of course, as he outgrows, so when he's young, you give him candies and treats. And then he gets a little older, you give him games. You know, as he matures, the incentives have to change. But it's only when he's very advanced that he begins to realize that those things that he thought were the good are not, and the study itself begins to become the end in itself. That's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal of teaching, of learning, is to recognize that this is the only real good for man is knowledge. But the only way to go about that is through low lishma. So therefore the Vilna Gaon is not against low lishma. That's a cardinal principle of Judaism. The only thing is that a person should have a honest recognition of where he stands. Now, what's the idea, with that in mind, what's the idea of serving God with the Yetzer Hara? What is that for? And we respect that. I think the classical example that's used, you can choose others, is the case of a person who has a very powerful aggressor, or sadistic component, in his personality. So they give him, what's the advice? To become a shoker, a ritual slaughter. That's a simple example. That a person can serve God. That is to say, you see, from this, that Judaism does not view the instinct per se as being evil, quite differently than the Christianity views the impulse. It's an evil impulse. You are defined by your impulse. Now, there's nothing evil about it because it exists because that's the way man was created. You can't refer to the creation, anything in the creation as being the evil, or this fact that man has a sexual desire. Sexual desire is not defined, it's not evil. It's good. It's part of the creation. Yeah, it's hard to say it's good, it's hard to say it's not. It's part of the creation. So it's good. And God saw everything that he had created and it was good. So how could that be there? Now if that's the case, then the question is, how do we have a concept of an evil information altogether? Since everything we're talking about is the creation, concerning which God said that God saw that all he had created, and behold, it was very good. So now how are you going to even talk about such a concept? That's where the question leads to. That's good. Now, I was accepting the idea that this thing is an evil inclination, just what you do with it. Now I'm saying that the whole idea doesn't make any sense at all. Because we're talking about things that exist only because of the will of the Creator. And therefore, everything that the Creator created is good. Has to be good. And that's what the Torah says. So the very notion of an evil inclination seems to be contrary to the basic foundation of Judaism. How does Judaism maintain a notion which is contrary to its basic foundation? It can't be. So we had a discussion of the concept of serving God with the Yetzer Hara, but we paused and we said, how can it be that there is Jitan? Since the Yetzer Hara is part of the creation, it's part of man. And man is a part that has been created by God. It's not something which man created. It's been implanted, so to speak. And as part of the creation, it says concerning which God saw that all that he created was, and was good, it was very good. So how can we even cast your term such that we make a distinction between the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov? What do you mean? The Yetzer HaTov, I understand. But when you call it there's no need to. The only reason you identify it as Tov is because you have another one you've identified as Ra. But this whole thing doesn't seem to make any sense at all. Can we say that the sexual instinct is Ra? It's good. It's part of it's God's will that there should be a sexual instinct. So what's the idea of identifying instincts and saying that they're evil? Then you're condemning the creation. In other words, what Moshe said is that really there's nothing Ra at all. But there are different, first of all, you see from this that there's a classification. There are different types of yitzros. And even the Yetzer HaTov is a yetzer. It's an inclination. You know, it's an emotion, something which pulls you in a certain direction. It's an emotion which is pulling you in a certain direction. And the reason why they've classified certain inclinations, which ones fall under the heading of we have to know which ones fall under the heading of Ra. The ones that stem from the instinctual side of man, basically. Right? The aggressive, the sexual, the appetitive, and so forth, are Ra. Why are they Ra? Only because the natural tendency, the direction in which they are pushing you, is removed from the truth, from the good. That's why they're Ra. But they're not inherently evil. It's just that the basic tendency, from a descriptive standpoint, the basic thrust is to take you in a direction which is not in line with perfection, with truth. And as opposed to, so what is the Yetzer HaTov then? What is the Yetzer HaTov? Now the Yetzer HaTov is not good per se, as we said, because Chazal say that you have to serve God with your Yetzer HaTov. So it means to say that the Yetzer HaTov is not necessarily serving God. You have to use it to serve God, which is a funny kind of thing. And so it turns out that the Yetzer HaTov can be Ra, and the Yetzer Hara can be Tov. I mean, like a funny kind of a formula we have over here. We have to work this out. So what then is the Yetzer HaTov? And this answer should also explain why it is essential for you to use it properly. If you don't use it properly, it's not going to be good. It's going to be evil. So then it will become the Yetzer Hara. It does turn out, according to Judaism, that the Yetzer HaTov can become a Yetzer Hara. There are probably three forces over here. Right? Two inclinations, and then the you that we're talking to. Who's the third party? Who's the party that we're talking to? Well, the emotions that have compassion. Okay, alongside, there's two different sets of emotions in man. There's the most of that stems from the instinctual aggressive side, and then you have other emotions: emotions of shame, emotions of guilt, emotions of friendliness, of compassion. You see, and that's basically what we refer to as the Yetzer HaTov. Now, let's ask ourselves the question: why are these emotions any better than those emotions? They're all emotions. Compassion, ordinary compassion, we're talking about. Not philosophical compassion, ordinary compassion, like you see all the people in Oklahoma City, you know, coming out and expressing all this grief for their fellow citizens and so forth. That's not philosophical. That's a yetzer. That's a natural impulse. Because you see, they don't have the same compassion for the people that are being killed in Serbia or other, you know, victims in Israel. It doesn't mean a thing to them. They read about the same worst. This, you see how they react to this. This is like a totally different calamity. They feel so terrible and they're crying and this and that. Well, that's not philosophical compassion, because of what happened to another human being. It's simply because this is you. Okay? It's you identify with these people. It's a yetzer. It's an emotion. It's an emotional indulgence. So what's so good about that? Struck me anyway, you know, when they spoke about it, like, interview people like this is an unbelievable thing, and, you know, they couldn't contemplate such a thing, they couldn't imagine such a thing. And I was wondering, like, why is it, this has been going on? It's all over the world. You know, like, it's like some new revelation occurred that man can do such a thing to somebody else. This is what, you know, you can imagine how can children, buildings, this and that, the horror, the sheer horror is like something which is unimaginable. And I was wondering, where are these people been? Are they on some planet? Yeah, wow. Well, to us, how could it happen to us? That's missing. I mean, don't you know? It's the 20th century. This is not the worst. This is certainly not the worst. It's not the first. And it's going on every day. Buses are being blown up in Israel. In Serbia, people are being tortured. People are being killed. I mean, these things are going to children, infants. And Iraq invaded Kuwait, and they totally killed babies in the hospitals. What do you mean? All right, you feel bad that it happened to you, but you're acting as though you couldn't imagine that this is just inconceivable that these things can happen. That's right. What do you mean? How could a person talk that way? That it's inconceivable unless he's completely cruel and blind. Like he has no, this can't happen to me. He doesn't identify with what's going on in the rest of the world. I can tell him, like, he's in there, he reads about these things every day, and they don't mean a thing to him. He shrugs them off, they don't mean a thing to him. It's not part of his reality. Oh, boy, this happened to me? So what kind of a cruel person is that? That's a cruel individual that has no identification with anybody else except someone who's emotionally affiliated with himself.
Yes.
The basic definition is the same in both cases. And that is that it's not inherently a toe. It just means that the thrust is more in line with that which is truly good. The thrust, because there is a true good for man not to live his life purely in accordance with his lust, but to follow an objective truth. And to be able to restrain himself in line with that objective truth. And there's a series of yitzros within him which incline him in that direction. See, like compassion, the Ramban says, of all the emotions, compassion is the most important one to cultivate. Compassion. Because but not because if a person is compassionate, he's good, by definition, because we see that compassion can be the worst evil. So they'll say, Kalam Arachim Al-Achsar, Sofo, Leos, Achsar, Al-Rachman. Whoever has compassion for the cruel, any type of compassion, weakness for criminals, for Nazis, for terrorists, and so forth, is cruelty. That's the highest form of cruelty. So that's the body of Arachim. So a person who simply is acting out of his emotion of compassion is doing evil. So therefore, Judaism does not identify the good with any particular emotion. There's no particular emotion that a person can just follow. But people feel more comfortable. See, people feel much more comfortable when they're indulging the compassionate emotion than when they're indulging the aggressive emotion. That's the way a person is. You'll see that, by the way, with parenting, it comes into the picture. Parents, when they have to be tough and discipline the child, they will tend afterwards to feel a little, even if they do, sometimes they don't do it because of the emotional guilt. They feel guilty about it. Or they may do it, but they won't feel that comfortable about it. But if they are, for example, if a parent errs and is more aggressive, so to speak, or more, they discipline the child more than they should have. On that side, they feel terrible. But if they are on the other side, they give in to the child when they shouldn't have, when they should have disciplined the child, then they don't feel guilty. Even if they recognize afterwards, they don't feel guilty. Well, admit it was wrong, I should have done it, but they don't feel bad. Because the emotion of guilt is tied up with the aggressive impulse. Those emotions that I was being a nice guy. See, whenever a person commits, a person's feeling of guilt is not connected, unless he's perfected, is not connected with whether we do the right thing or the wrong thing. It's connected with certain emotions. And that's an imperfection. A person should work on that. A person, in other words, insofar as guilt is proper and appropriate for doing the wrong thing, a person should feel just as guilty when he was good, when he was a good guy, and he shouldn't have been, as when he was a bad guy, and he shouldn't have been. But when when you've been the bad guy, see, when you fire someone, or you're tough with someone, and you've been the bad guy, and then you recognize you shouldn't have, you're going to feel guilty. But when you've been the good guy, You may regret it and say, "Oh, it's stupid. I'm stupid." But you're not going to feel guilty. Why? Because you are in line with that. As long as you're in line with that emotion, that shows that your feelings of guilt are tied in with certain emotions, not with whether you did the correct thing or not. So that's the pshat, that a person can serve God. The entire objective is, you see, in Yad, this is the perfection of man and the service of God, to be in line with reality. Now, the way man is structured, he has different types of emotions, and it is possible to harness the energy of all of his emotions in the service of God. Every emotion, you see, the purpose of the good emotion is only to help you to counteract the bad emotion. The person needs help from emotion. In other words, the strength of his reason is not enough to control his sexual appetite. That's just the way it is. Unless of course you're talking about Tzaddikim. But the average individual has a lust for a married woman. But his mind tells him it's wrong, because you're going to break up the institution of marriage, and it's really not the proper thing. All these, the force of reason is insufficient. In a moment of passion, the emotion will just wipe it away. However, there's an emotion, there's fear. The fear will be found out, guilty, God will punish him, whatever it is. All these emotions come into the picture, and together with the force of reason, then it needs two against one. Then he has a chance. See? So that's why you have two different sets of emotions. But that's why it's addressing it to you, to the intelligence, to the that part of man which does the choosing, which makes the choices, the reasoning part of man, to utilize, you see, to harness, to be in control of all the forces in your personality, and to utilize them with chachma, to direct them towards the good. That's the meaning of that chazal. But there's nothing in man which by nature is evil or good. There's just different kinds of inclinations. And the Yetzer Hara can become the Yetzer Hatov if you use it properly. If you direct the energy, you find within yourself if you analyze, and that's the way man is structured, that virtually any type of emotion, instinct that he has, can find an outlet. He can find an outlet in a channel which will be beneficial to him. And virtually any other emotion that he has can find the outlet which will be destructive of mankind. And today our society is being destroyed by false compassion. False compassion for the criminals, and the liberalism, and giving in, and so forth, and tolerance. Tolerance is a very nice thing, because you tolerate all types of deviant behaviors, and also the desire to help can be a nice thing. But then when you create a crazy welfare system and affirmative action, you destroy society. See? So our society today is suffering more from the good inclination, I would say, than from the evil inclination necessarily, although there's a strong dose of both.
A question. That the Chazal say that the Jew has three distinguishing characteristics. Very important idea, but practically speaking. Especially when you're, especially when you're in the area of looking for Shidduchim, look for the important virtues are much more important. Not to deny, of course, there's got to be the emotional connection, but the underlying basis should be the virtues. The three distinguishing characteristics are, was it Rachmanim first? Rachmanim, they have mercy. Baishanim, Husha means modesty, shame. And the Gomle Chasadim. And they do Gmilas Chesed, acts of compassion. The three distinguishing features of the Jew. The person, you can both name a person. The person doesn't have these qualities, so he should be suspect. Jews see a person that has no compassion is cruel. That's not a Jewish thing, and that's questionable. Lacking in busha, totally uninhibited. Uninhibited, has no. There's no control, no modesty whatsoever, and so forth. So then one should question whether he's Jewish or not.
Now by the Givonim. The Givonim lo l'bnei Yisrael hema. Because they refuse to forgive
That was the fate of Shaul. When Shaul, you know, killed out that whole city, no, they were Kahanim, and they used to supply them, you know, the story, the big Givonim in Tanakh. So they were very upset, and David tried to appease them, but they wouldn't accept any appeasement. So he says, the Givonim long as they were him. They were lacking in the mercy. They wouldn't forgive. That's not a Jewish characteristic. These are good emotions. A person should work. I just want to, at least for the time being, to reach some conclusion over here. What we're saying is, we shouldn't be indifferent to the emotions within ourselves. We're working on ourselves on two different levels. We're working on ourselves to improve our knowledge of the good and our relationship to the good. Yeah, but we're emotional beings, and we try to cultivate the proper emotion. A person should try and cultivate the emotion of compassion. But if it exists within him in such a way that it prevents him from taking proper action, again, like the Christian idea that turn the other cheek and to tolerate evil, and he's incapable of executing terrorists, then that's terrible evil, and then that's a foolishness, that's not the proper thing. But that does not mean today that he should cultivate the emotion, because the emotion will help him, but the emotion should always be under the control of his reason. So there's two different concepts here. There's cultivation of certain emotions. Because by and large, you need these emotions. I mean, if you're by and large a cold and distant person and a fool and this and that and insensitive, so then that's the way you live your life. And when people come to your door for help and so on and so forth, you're going to follow your basic gut reaction. Your basic gut reaction is going to be, get this guy out of here. I don't want to be bothered. I'm busy. I'm here, you know. You see, your basic emotional structure of the personality does play a role. You have to realize that. A lot of things happen because of your initial reaction. A lot of opportunities are missed. If you don't cultivate within yourself intellectual curiosity, which means that there are plenty of people out there that have very, very good minds, very good heads. And I see, like on Shabbos, people come to my school, you draw them in, they get involved, and they really like to think and that. But other than that, when they're gone during the week, they're not going to follow through, because they have not developed. That's something else. It's one thing to be capable of relating to an intellectual experience. It's another thing to cultivate the habit and then make yourself into one who loves and enjoys. It's part of his life. That's cultivating something. Now, what you cultivate within you has a decisive impact upon, very important impact upon, subsequent activities. If you are a Baal Rachman, then you're going to react to situations in a certain way. Now, this very same person who's basically cold and callous doesn't mean that he can't do a good deed. Yeah, given the proper circumstances, he may give the charity, and he's in a situation where there's an appeal and so forth, he gets involved, he can give a big donation. You see? But by and large, the course of his life is not going to be conducted that way. So it's important to cultivate proper emotions, because those emotions set the stage for how you're going to react. If you develop intellectual curiosity, so then wherever you go and in every situation you're involved in, you're gonna be asking questions, you're gonna be thinking, you're gonna be learning. I mean, new doors will open to you. If you don't develop that, so you're gonna be passive about these things. You're gonna miss out a lot. But the point is, however, so these are three crucial qualities in terms of perfection. But the moral virtues, the person doesn't have these moral virtues, so he's very far removed from perfection. But this doesn't contradict what we said. It means to say that the way we study today is that these emotions in and of themselves do not constitute perfection. But they certainly pave the road. The person has to pave the way to set the stage. And a personality which is refined and perfected is much more in line with that, with the main challenge of utilization of the mind. You see, he's in line with the good. It's necessary to do so. It's necessary to conquer the instincts and to set yourself up in a certain way, to develop a certain personality. That's the personality of the Jew. And if he doesn't develop that personality, then it's going to be very far removed. That's one of these steps in the road to perfection. You see? The perfection of the emotions.
perfection of the midah. The question I'm raising is whether the concept of the Yemos HaMashiach, the Messianic era, reflects on this. Because it does seem that there'll be a complete change in the value system of mankind. That there'll be peace, the wine and the land, the Rambam says, that's an allegory. Somebody needs to say that there'll be no longer aggression and killing and competition, and the entire world will be filled with one objective. The objective will be to find the way to discover the truth, to study Torah and so forth. And but you'll say, well, maybe that's because there'll be a change in the nature of mankind, which is the Ramban's position, because that's how he understands that the Lord will circumcise your heart. The Ramban learns there will be a fundamental change in human nature, but the Rambam learns that there will not be a fundamental change in human nature. That there's no miracles, in other words. The Rambam holds that there'll be no, all the laws of nature will be in effect in the Messianic era. There's no difference between the Yemos HaMashiach and our times, except for the Shibud Malchus. So we'll be free from oppression. We won't be oppressed anymore. The Jewish nation will no longer have enemies and oppression. So we'll restore the Jewish state properly, the Torah state, the building of the Beis HaMikdash, the return of the Torah leaders, and all of mankind will look up to the Jews for insight into the truth, how to serve God. So there will be a fundamental change, but not because of any change in the natural order. So I'm wondering if that reflects on this issue. I'm wondering if, from the Rambam's position, that all of mankind, in other words, that once you set certain factors into motion, and you have a whole universe, the whole universe will be revolving around the system of true ideas, a whole culture, a universal culture. So then from that point on, mankind will be different. It might effectuate a whole change in mankind. So it can become. According to that, I'm suggesting that it can become internalized. The cultural, things which begin culturally can become internalized over time. So that by and large, a certain people, which has practiced a certain culture, so the individuals will now be more by constitution. It will affect the constitution, and constitutionally speaking, they'll be more inclined towards kindness and compassion and so forth, as opposed to aggression and so forth.